3CR podcast, recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
There we are, acres and acres of tar and cement, and it's City Limits. It's the, I think it's the fifth, well, it must be the fifth Wednesday because we're about to go to July tomorrow or the next day. Next day. I know it's the next day because then I can have a drink again. Zeb Peake over there, and I'm Kevin Healy. And Zeb, do you want a cup of tea, Zeb?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, look, I'll pour them as soon as we tell people what's on the program. And we've got two guests today. We're going to talk about Kate Shaw from Melbourne University about the rally next Saturday for public housing, which is around about the question, of course, of the demolition of the high-rise towers. So Kate will be on very shortly. And the second half, as we said last week, we've got David Spratt, a long-term conservationist environmentalist who's been involved with environmental issues for many, many years and, of course, wrote the book Code Red back in, I think it's about 2008, in which he warned what was going to happen and no one's yet listened in government levels anyway. So David's going to talk to us about the current situation, and I know he's it's not going to cheer people up much because I think he's pretty pessimistic about what's going on in the world. But that's today's program. Now, a cup of tea, and I did say, I don't know, you're a bit on tenterhooks there because I did say I've got a big problem for you. Yeah, a big difficult one.
Yeah.
Well, but you did say you want a cup of tea.
Yes, that's an easy choice.
Okay, well, the choice you've got to make is, and this is the bit where you've got to, this is the difficult one, you've got a choice of an all-white cup or an all-white cup. So which one do you want? This is a Henry Ford type choice.
Oh, yeah.
And his was black. Like his soul.
Well, I'll choose the one on the left.
Of your left or my left, though?
decisions. I think your left.
Okay, so you get this one.
Yeah. Okay. Got to choose a leftist mug.
There you are. Okay, now that's solved the tea problem. Well, we've got to drink it. I'll just have a sip of tea. Hang on. Before we go to Kate, a couple of small things. Well, not small, but a couple of items. It came out this week, an analysis by the Australian Taxation Office and backed up by the super itself, that workers are being stung, and so one in four workers is not having their proper super paid into their accounts, and they're owed millions. And in fact, nationally, unpaid super cost Australians $5.7 billion, or $110 a week in 2022-23, and this, of course, then impacts on what they end up with at the end of the whole thing. So it's pretty serious.
One in four. That's pretty high. I know there was the recent kind of scandal with the All Our Welcome Bakery, where staff weren't being paid super. I'm just going to say this is all alleged because I can't find an article about it, but I think supposedly it was written on their pay sheets, but it wasn't actually going into the account.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be a regular rort. And, of course, when companies hit the wall, you find they owe heaps of money to workers, including their superannuation, and it's quite serious, quite serious. The AUKUS situation, the US is reviewing it, and it may, in fact, the bloke who's reviewing it was pretty antagonistic to AUKUS himself, and it's quite possible he'll recommend that the US not go ahead with it, having already given them heaps of money, millions and millions, and millions to Britain, or there's a speculation in the financial press that he'll actually ask for even more money from Australia for AUKUS to keep going. And knowing Richard Marles and Anthony Albanese, they will immediately do whatever the US says and give them more money. But the incredible thing was that just a week or two ago, Richard Marles handed them another, I think, $800 million on top of the original to keep the thing going. Now, one would have thought that if the US is reviewing it and there's a possibility it won't go ahead, one might have delayed that payment until the review comes out and we see what's in it, rather than hand over $800 million, because we know that if they don't go ahead, we don't get our money back. So...
Well, yeah, one might have thought that.
Yeah.
But there we go. Just, you know.
But one Richard Marles did not think that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then again, we know what a giant mind he's got. And so probably explains it, really. He's also signed a deal last week with the UK when they had the UK Defence Minister and their Foreign Affairs Minister here last week with Penny and Richard. And you keep wondering, you know, you saw his counterpart walking around everywhere with Richard, talking to him and laughing together and shaking hands a million times a day. And you kept thinking, I wonder what these people, if they've got a brain in their head, think of Richard Marles and his conversation and what he's all about. But anyway, that aside, again, we've agreed to, again, give them money to make subs and to sell us subs, and we're going to start making some here. But the contract is such that if there's any problem with them, we can't sue. It specifically says in the contract we signed last week that if the things aren't up to standard, then we have no recourse. Which, again, they seem to sign the most wonderful one-sided... Yeah.
It's just such a good deal for the US and the UK.
Yes, they do seem to be doing well out of it, don't they? So that's that one. And with the coming up next month, of course, there's this roundtable conference with business and unions and everyone else the government promised pre-election and which is going to go ahead. But the business community this time is getting together very strongly, and they're really working hard to water down industrial relations legislation, and they're desperate, of course, for what they call tax reform. And tax reform always means they pay a lot less and we pay a lot more. So we can look forward to see what happens there and whether the government caves into them or...
I found an article about that All Our Welcome bakery thing. So three All Our Welcome bakeries that operated in Melbourne's north and northeast, employing 61 people, closed their doors. It was fairly recently. The ABC has reported staff were owed $243,000 in superannuation and $125,000 in leave entitlements. So, yes, something went on. The company entered voluntary admission in February this year with more than $1 million in debt. Yes, just one example of the superannuation thing.
Indeed. Okay. It's bloody awful, isn't it? Okay, look, let's get Kate Shaw and let's talk about Saturday's rally.
Alrighty.
Bisexual Alliance Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people, including bi, pan, regardless of label or no label at all, their partners and allies. Bisexual Alliance runs discussion groups in person and online. The group offers a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. Bisexual Alliance is especially keen to hear from multigender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations of $2 or more to Bisexual Alliance are now tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at bi-alliance.org, email info@bi-alliance.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.
A 3CR supporter. I'm bisexual.
Bisexual. 3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters, on behalf of the Bumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
Okay, on the line, Kate Shaw. Kate, I've lost track these days. What's your title these days?
Oh, I don't know.
No, okay, your title's I don't know. Okay.
I'm a senior research fellow at the University of Melbourne in the School of Geography. I'm an urban geographer.
That's it, the urban. Still, well, that's last time, so actually I could have said that at the start, couldn't I?
Yes.
But you're here today to talk about the rally next Saturday and why we're having the rally next Saturday, and what is the background to this?
There's a really big joining up of activist groups from RAHU, the Renters and Housing Union, to Save Public Housing Collective, to 44 Flats United, which is a group of mainly residents and supporters of the 44 towers that Dan Andrews announced on his departing carpet. Would be demolished when was that, in 23, I think. Stop the Demolition is another group. So there's a kind of, finally, a joining up and standing together of a lot of disparate activist groups that have long fought about, you know, merits or otherwise of community versus public housing. And finally, everybody says, sort of gone for fuck's sake. Public housing is what it's about, and we don't need to discuss the role of community housing here. This is a rally that everybody is standing together on to protect public housing. So Saturday the 2nd, this coming Saturday, all of those groups and their supporters and residents of Powers and many other people will get together at the State Library at 11 a.m. to march to Parliament. And I believe that it will be emceed by none other than the illustrious Evan Healy.
Yes, thanks to your persuasive talents, Kate. But what is the current state of the demolitions?
There are pickets at the Flemington and North Melbourne towers. There's sort of drilling and testing work going on at both of those towers in preparation for demolition. Even though there's still plenty of residents there, but it's sort of, you know, soil testing, drilling, and preparations for demolition, but also preparation for sale, I think, is more important. For it. I mean, the testing is about preparing the land for tender, giving as much information as possible to prospective private tenderers. that's what it's about.
And in the end, there'll be no public housing as we know public housing, I believe.
Yes, that is the plan. So of the 44 towers, the two in Carlton on Elgin and Nicholson Street that are being replaced will be public housing. That is the result of a federal pass scheme. But all of the other towers will be replaced by the usual public-private mix, and public will be social, which means, of course, community housing. So there won't be any more public housing operated by the state.
And the government, of course, is saying that the pre-testing of soil and the construction itself is not actually demolition, but that's pretty obfuscationary, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's really, I'm actually currently at the Richmond estate where there's clearance works going on around the walk-ups, some of which are still inhabited. So a playground was pulled down last week, and, you know, trees were taken out, and it's all under the guise of safety work and cleaning up. And, I mean, there is merit to that. The playground had sort of pretty nasty tan bark and it was used as a sort of a hang for people to shoot up. And it's right next to residents and no kids used it. But, you know, it's just sort of thing of, okay, we'll pull it down in order to change the use. It's very much the same thinking that goes into pulling down the buildings because you don't like the residents. That's what it's about. They don't like the poor is really what it's about. Anyway, so there's clearance happening here now. There are rocks being, you know, sort of boulders and sort of landscaping details and sort of, you know, miscellaneous stuff being taken away, clearly in preparation for demolition. But, you know, there are residents still here and it's a slippery slope. Oh, not a slippery slope, it's just a continuum. There won't be a moment at which you can see demolition works starting. And, you know, legitimate clearing and making it safe ending.
And indeed, we know there's been architects saying that they can be well saved, just a little bit of work and at a fraction of the cost of demolition and rebuilding, they could be saved and made better.
Precisely. And these walk-ups, I mean, it's quite interesting. We've been talking about it all morning. The walk-ups on Richmond, they've kind of set back in a little bit from Lennox Street. So the old 1960s walk-ups that fronted Lennox Street, they were demolished 5 years ago in 2021. That site has sat vacant since then. And now what you can see from Lennox Street as you go through is another lot of walk-ups that were built in the 1980s. And they're very similar to the walk-ups that were built on the Collingwood estate, you know, around Dyke Street and Palmer Street and McCutcheon Way, indeed presided over by the Minister for Housing in the 80s, Andrew McCutcheon, who is part of probably one of the more enlightened Labor governments that Victoria has seen in the last century. And they're similar stock, and they're beautiful. They're sort of brick-clad, nice balconies. They're three stories, and very, very comfortable, you know, attractive. I mean, anybody would want to live there. They're beautiful. They're well maintained at Collingwood, and it's a really nice place to walk through. So the stock here at Richmond is identical, but hasn't been maintained in the same way for reasons of obvious long-term planning on the part of Homes Victoria. And so now they are all being emptied out. And they've got graffiti and some of the windows are being boarded up. So, they obviously have to be demolished. Well, no, they don't. They're actually very sound construction and they could easily be retrofit. So there's a report that has come out of our Melbourne Uni, out of the retrofit lab, that is actually looking at precisely these kinds of situations and saying not only is it environmentally, obviously, more sound to maintain and retrofit than pull down and rebuild, but economically and socially, obviously, it's such a better approach. There's a particular belligerence and pig-headedness behind the insistence on pulling these down that I actually really have trouble understanding.
And the end result is, of course, that these things end up in the hands of the private sector and usually at far, far below the real cost of the land, and as you proved in the Kensington study that you did.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes, of course. I mean, I don't really have trouble understanding it at all. I just have to.
No, about capitalism, Kate.
No. Yes, of course. It's about clearing the land for public-private development. The public component will be community housing, and the private component will be enormously profitable for the developer, and. Oh, look, and there'll be more housing provided as a result, notwithstanding that the community housing is not public housing and notwithstanding that the increase will be minimal in what's here now. It will mostly be high-end, or market rate is high-end, but it'll be more than, median market rate, private housing, which is not what this housing crisis needs. We've got plenty of high-end upmarket rate housing. The problem is affordable housing. The problem is, even that word has become sullied, hasn't it? It's hard to talk about affordable housing. That genuinely.
Well, it's a meaningless term, isn't it?
Well, it's become so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because the government defines it as affordable housing, 90% of market rent.
That's right, which has all the homeless people on the streets cheering and yelling and thinking, any day now I'll have my own home.
Yay!
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Look,
yeah.
Kate, last year, or at least the matter was taken to the Supreme Court, which in a quite incredible ruling, as we know, said that the government doesn't have to consider the tenants' human rights when deciding to knock over their houses, and in fact has public interest immunity, which is being appealed at the moment. Now, I would have thought, seeing it's being appealed, there really should be an injunction on all the work until that appeal is heard. But
I would think so. And so there should be, indeed. But, I guess Homes Victoria and this government is operating in the similarly lawless context that other Western governments are starting to establish for themselves. Not only is there an appeal, but I mean, one of the things that I found most interesting about the court action was that when the magistrate ordered, no, it was a judge, it was a Supreme Court.
Supreme Court judge.
When the judge requested Homes Victoria to produce the evaluations of the buildings that they were intending to demolish, and Simon Newport, the Secretary of Homes Victoria, obfuscated and dissembled and well, actually, my reading of it was pretty clearly that there are no evaluations. And if there are, they've been done retrospectively. but in any event, he went away and prepared a legal case with their representatives, came back to the court and said, we're not legally bound to. We don't have to. They're cabinet documents. They're commercial in confidence. We don't need to release them. And the court accepted that. So there is now a legal case that protects the government from telling us what they're doing.
Yeah, you just answered what was going to be my next question, actually. But clearly, there's a strong suspicion that there was no argument at all put before the cabinet. It was just a brainwave by Dan Andrews at the time.
That's right.
Yeah, so Saturday's rally, it's clearly to try to save the towers and save the housing. What does happen to the people who get displaced? I mean, many of these people have a real community, particularly, say, North Africans, who say they feel they have a real community in those high-rise towers. What happens to them?
In simple terms, they go to the top of the existing public housing waiting list. There are efforts by Homes Victoria to relocate people far and wide. Who knows where they'll end up. And then there's this usual kind of manipulation that goes on about, you know, we're going to offer you this place or that place or that place, and if you don't accept one of those, then you're really going to be in trouble. So it's a kind of a process of manipulation and terrorising that makes people leave. Very few people are able to relocate to a place close by where they live now, close to their existing networks. They're just high priority on the waiting list, which means, of course, and there's 10,000 residents in the towers that are going to get demolished. So it means that 10,000 people are going to jump ahead of all of the others on the waiting list, and everybody's just going to be waiting longer for more housing because they're not building more housing, and this is the ridiculous thing about it. And again, I come back to Richmond, but so that land along Lennox Street has been sitting empty for 5 years. For all of the desperation with which this government bangs on about, well, we need to build new housing, private housing. They haven't done a thing. It's just still standing fallow. The displacements are going to be ugly, as displacement always is. Violent, uprooting, disorienting, and 10,000 people are going to be victims of it.
All right, Kate, we'll have to finish there because I've got to move on to David Spratt. But Kate, that could all be avoided, of course, if they simply did not tear the towers down in the first place, which is what Saturday's all about. So just to repeat again, the Rally Saturday.
Rally Saturday, 11 a.m. At the State Library, and it will march from State Library to Parliament House, and it'll finish sort of around 1:32. And there will be music and speakers and joy to be had in everybody getting together to try to persuade the government to approach its citizenry with humanity.
Good way to finish, although something positive on City Limits is not good, but we'll cop it. Okay, Kate, look, thanks for your time, and I'll see you Saturday.
Yeah, see you Saturday. See all of you Saturday, I hope.
Okay, yeah, right, yeah. Thanks, Kate.
Bye.
Kate Shaw there from, as you can tell, geographer at Melbourne Uni, and part of the whole collective. There's a whole list of organisations, in fact, I've got before me who are part of this collective for Saturday, and good luck to them.
Yeah. So we'll go to another short break and get David's bread.
We shall do.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Are you stressed about your home loan? Right now, more Victorians than ever are stressed about home loan repayments. If you're going through a period of temporary financial hardship, you can ask your lender for hardship assistance. Lenders can agree to reduce your interest rate, extend the term of your loan, freeze interest, put a temporary hold on payments, or reduce your payments. If you only own one property that you live in, and either you are affected by family violence or your household earnings are less than $75,000, contact Mortgage Stress Victoria for free help from a lawyer, social worker, or financial counsellor on 1800 572 292 or www.mortgagestress.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
The Melbourne Documentary Film Festival returns to Cinema Nova this July for Past, Present, Future. Beginning on July 15, warm up the cold winter days with a revitalising collection of local and international documentaries from independent and emerging talents. Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, a jewel in Melbourne's cultural crown. Screening from July the 15th for a limited time at Cinema Nova. 380 Lygon Street, Carlton. Cinema Nova is a 3CR supporter.
Okay, on the line we've got David Spratt, who is a long-time campaigner on energy and climate. I think he's well known to many of our listeners, and of course the author way back of Code Red, which warned people back in about 2008 or whenever, thereabouts somewhere, but no one's listened. But David, our current minister, Chris Bowen, keeps telling us that the government's doing great things and more than the previous government did, although that would require them to do just anything, I suppose. But where are we at? Has Chris Bowen, in fact, got the thing under control, do you think?
Well, the evidence is that Australians' emissions are not going down. Is that signal all right, Kevin? I'm getting a big echo.
It's okay, our end, but...
Okay, I'll deal with the echo in my ear. The Australian Institute's analysis shows that overall Australians' emissions are not going down. Yes, we're using less coal in electricity production, but use of oil and gas is going up. So rather than declining sharply, our emissions have essentially been flat for a number of years. So that's what the data says. Yeah. And of course, that doesn't include all the emissions from our exports of coal and gas. And there was some data out the other day saying that in terms of the export of emissions outside of national borders, Australia is the second largest polluter in the world. And they're not, for weird reasons, they're not counted in our own emissions. So, I mean, that puts Australia really at just about the worst end. I mean, a larger emitter of of greenhouse gases in Tato than any of the Gulf states, for example.
Yeah, they're called Scope 3 emissions, of course. And,
that's right.
And Woodside, which is one of the big exporters, refuses to include Scope 3 in its emissions reporting. But one of the more incredible headlines, I think, in recent times, this goes back a couple of months, but when that blackout occurred in Spain, a headline in The Age, this is from our old mate Meg O'Neill of Woodside, is a lovely woman, but the Spain blackout shows now, this is an incredible headline, shows need for gas in a greener world, Woodside CEO says.
Well, I mean, how long will you take to pick that apart? I mean, the fact is that the gas industry is trying to sell itself as less dirty than coal. And the evidence does not support that proposition, because with gas production, you get what are called fugitive emissions. I mean, anybody who's seen those great gas platforms in the North West Shelf or anywhere in the world, you see gas being flared off. You know, these tall chimneys which are burning 24 hours a day, and there are fugitive emissions. That is gas leaking out of the ground with gas extraction, whether it be fracked or otherwise. And the research shows that when you take those fugitive emissions into account, gas is as dirty as coal.
Yes, and yet just a couple of weeks ago when UNESCO, in fact, put the rock art on the heritage list, despite an extension of Woodside until 2070... Roger Cook and the current Minister Murray Watt and Meg herself said that it proves industry and the rock art can coexist. And yet there's already a long history of the gas causing damage to the rock art, isn't there?
Well, of course. I mean, this is a triumph of spin over substance, isn't it? This is the world we live in now. Fake it till you make it. And that's about par for the course. I mean, I don't think our government's really much different in the sort of spin we get each day out of them. I mean, for anybody who saw Chris Bowen on 7:30 report last night talking about Australia's emissions targets for 2035, what was really noticeable was he spent the whole time talking about all the good news about batteries and solar and, you know, this and that and the things they were doing and how many more megawatts they've got. But he didn't actually talk about the impacts of climate change on people's lives at all. So there's almost this schism in the government where they just want to talk about renewables all the time, but not talk about what climate's actually going to do to people's lives. And it's obviously, I've done some analysis of it, of his speeches and so on. And I've met him and he says, David, we don't want bad news. People don't want fear. They just want hope. Climate change and green energy is a good news story, and that's the sort of pitch we're getting, which means that there's no discussion in Australia of where we're actually going.
And can you speak a bit more about how climate activists, or how you think climate activists should be approaching our activism now that we have reached 1.5 degrees? It feels like these targets that we've kind of put up as a goal to reach, you know, they keep on falling by the wayside as we pass each of them.
Yes, it's a complex question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an easy one. Look, I mean, I think there are two parts to that question. One is sort of scientifically, what sort of planet do we want to live on? I mean, what would be a planet that would actually support humanity and the natural ecosystems as they exist now? And it's really clear that, I mean, 2023 was 1.5, last year was 1.6, this year might be a bit cool, maybe 1.4, 1.45, but, you know, we're at that 1.5 level now, and James Hansen, who's now retired, who was the head of climate science for NASA and sort of the godfather of modern climate science in a nice sort of way, he's sort of saying, for all practical purposes, we're there. So that's pretty devastating, because that was the aim of the Paris Agreement in 2015, to keep warming to 1.5, and in fact the recent International Court of Justice has reaffirmed 1.5 as sort of a scientific basis. The problem with that is that 1.5 is not safe, and this is the discussion that I don't think the climate movement really wants to have, and why we've just put out a discussion paper on it. I mean, any science will tell you in the long run, and it, you know, it takes hundreds of years, in the long run, each 1 degree of warming will produce 10 to 20 metres of sea level rise. This is well known from climate history. I mean, the last time we were 4 degrees cooler than this in the, you know, the ice ages 20,000 years ago, the sea levels were 80 to 100 metres lower than they were now because all the ice was stacked up at the poles and in other places, and you could just about walk from here to Tasmania. So we know that every 1 degree produces 10 to 20 metres of sea level rise, and that, of course, would make a complete mess of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, the world's great alluvial deltas, the Nile, the Ganges, the Mekong, and so on. And we also have evidence, which is now clear. I mean, I noticed David Caroli was quoted in the other day about this, and he said, well, look, 1.5 is here, and the Barrier Reef is dead at 1.5. So the question is, do you keep on saying, yes, we've got the 1.5, but, you know, if we could get warming back there, that'd be a good outcome? I don't think so. I mean, we've got Australian scientists saying we actually need to try and cool the system back to where we were to maintain the life and the sea levels that we have. So I think that's one part of the answer. The second is that I think the climate movement in Australia has taken what I would call a bright-siding approach, that sort of positive psychology approach. I mean, it's quite, they said it quite openly, you know, people want hope, not fear. You know, you get this hope, not fear sort of stuff all the time. And it actually doesn't work. If you think about it, the people who've most mobilised the climate movement in the last 5 or 10 years have been people like Greta Thunberg and Roger Hallam, an XR, who've combined a really brutal, people call it a really brutal assessment of where we're going with the sort of answers and paths we need. And the same thing's true of health promotion. I mean, if you look at campaigns about smoking or AIDS or even COVID and getting a vaccine, I mean, all the evidence shows that is to motivate people about a big problem, you've got to do three things. One, be really honest about the problem. I mean, the Grim Reaper, you know, the smoking ads, you're going to die, pictures on cigarette boxes. Be really brutal about the problem. Give people an answer and a path, you know, an agency to get there. I mean, I remember there was a quit ad which sort of said, every time you quit, you get closer to quitting in the long run. And as an ex-smoker, I knew what that meant. I mean, if you quit and don't quite make it, you can try again. So, I mean, I think we need to be really honest about where we're going, and the movement is not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, in fact, of course, David, Zeb is of the generation that's going to have to live with this for decades.
Yeah.
And I think there's an argument that the heads of the big resource companies, the Woodsides and the Santoses and the ConocoPhillips and all those people, and Chevron, etc., they could almost be charged with crimes against humanity, couldn't they?
Well, indeed, together with the Israeli Prime Minister and many others.
Yeah, yeah.
in a different purpose. And I mean, and that's a really interesting story about, I mean, we talk a lot about warfare at the moment in the Middle East and Europe and so on, but I mean, there's been a lot of lawfare recently as well. I mean, listeners will know that the two Torres Strait Islanders took a case to the federal court, which the result came down recently, in which they were saying that the Australian government had a duty of care to protect them from climate change, which is undoubtedly true. And, I mean, if you read the judgment, the Australian government and the Solicitor General argued against the case, which tells you everything about the current government. But, I mean, the judge sort of said morally they were right, that it does have a duty of care, but legally on some horrible, you know, technicality, he couldn't find in their favour. But, I mean, a much better result came from this court case, which just concluded with the International Court of Justice, where a couple of law students from Vanuatu initiated in 2019. So it's taken some time, but you have seen the headlines, and it was a very positive outcome. And Australia is a member of the International Court of Justice. I mean, people like the United States and China and Israel aren't, for the obvious reasons. But the court came out and said that climate change imperils all forms of life, that it's an existential risk, that there's an obligation of governments to act, and that they might be subject to legal consequences if they don't act. Governments like Australia's went to the court and said, oh, this could only be considered within the Paris Agreement, that is the 2015 Climate Policy Making Agreement. And obviously companies like the US have left and would then say, well, that's not us. But the court said, no, it deals with a whole broader area of human rights law. And people, human rights law requires the protection of the climate system. It upheld 1.5 as a scientific basis. And really importantly, it said it provides, and it does provide, solid legal argument for domestic cases. So while this was an advisory opinion, because the court doesn't have the power to enforce these things, it's an advisory opinion. It did say that, and lawyers here are saying it provides a much more solid basis when, for example, if the Torres Strait Islanders went back to the court, or other cases here about new coal and gas mines, that this International Court of Justice ruling is, you know, a really significant piece of evidence to have. So that was good.
And, of course, we've got a UN spokesperson here at the moment saying much the same thing, following up.
I mean, clearly they said, you know, there's an obligation on countries, and they said an obligation on countries to regulate the companies that they have, you know, legal jurisdiction over. So, and they also said that emitters who fail to act according with the science may be liable for reparations. So, I mean, yes, it's an advisory opinion, but it certainly, you know, moves the general atmosphere in terms of legal cases forward. And I mean, the other good news, I think it was last week, there was a in the Hunter Valley, which, you know, is the headquarters of Australia's coal exports. The local muscle group, community group, went to the New South Wales Court of Appeal because that really progressive former Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek had approved a licence for what was called the Mount Pleasant coal mine in the Hunter Valley, which in its lifetime was going to produce 867 million tonnes of CO2. And the Court of Appeal found in favour of the local residents. So, I mean, that's another case where this lawfare is having, you know, having some effect.
And, of course, you regularly hear the big resource companies saying government should legislate that they can't use lawfare, even though the law is on the side of the environmentalists half the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course. I mean, that's their business model, isn't it? We wouldn't expect them to be any more moral than that.
It's good capitalist law.
I'm sorry to say, you know. I mean, it's interestingly, it's the same thing that's happening in international financial circles where after Paris, and this was led by the guy who's now the Canadian Prime Minister when he's head of the what we call the Reserve Bank in the UK, led a whole thing about the responsibilities of financial institutions to take climate into account. They had a thing called the Network for Greening the Financial System and, you know, all sorts of government-based reserve banks signed up and sort of said, yes, we've got to take these risks into account. And then that started to spread into the corporate world. And now all of that's being reversed. And they're all going, no, that's not our moral responsibility. So that's the argument that you get from the mining industry, of course.
Well, you get from them, of course, you also get there's a tar room trough, which is... they probably caught up with this one, but it's 50,000 square kilometres up in Queensland where Shell is finding all sorts of things. And the Natural Resources Minister in Queensland said it's incredible potential, not just for gas, but also for oil. And Sol Kavonich, an analyst at MST Marquee, described Taroom as one of the most watched new oil and gas plays in Australia. It is one of the very few plays with the potential to provide a meaningful new lick of East Coast gas supply. Some recent results suggest it may be able to revitalise Australia's oil production and fuel security. So they're still gung-ho.
Well, this is like Purdue Pharma and OxyContin, isn't it? I mean, you know, an opiate in the United States, you're a private business, you've got a product which you can manufacture or extract, and you can make a lot of money out of it, and you can lie and deceive people about it, and that's your business model.
Yeah, well, they're going. I mean, just a headline, you don't need to read on. ConocoPhillips seeks new oil drilling in Arctic as well. Well, they cause it to thaw and then they move in and exploit it again.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not a psychologist or an expert in sort of sociopathic business behaviour. I wish I was sometimes, but I mean, it's sort of both obvious and just completely disturbing and not understandable that these people behave this way. I mean, in one sense, the war in Ukraine provided a huge. There was a burst in energy prices. They tried to cut Russia out of the scene so other people could make more money. So there's a bit of a gold rush as a consequence of that. And they just see the money and they go for it. I mean, okay, that's what business is. But on the other hand, they are quite consciously creating the conditions where their own grandkids, despite their ideas of, you know, living on a sheltered island or you know, $500 million boat charging around the Southern Ocean or something. I mean, their grandchildren are going to live in hell, and it is weird, isn't it?
Absolutely, because we saw, well, Vanuatu, of course, and some young people took that case to the federal, to the international court, but also we did see during that court case shots of the terrible damage caused at the in the Tiwi Islands and in those islands up there. And yet they just keep going instead of saying, well, that's proof that we just need to pull back.
Yes, but I mean, it's of a different scale, but in substance, the morality is the same as the tobacco industry, isn't it? I mean, like, I'm just saying this is not a new thing. I mean, this is a way that business and capitalism have always worked in a way. I mean,
asbestos did the same, of course.
I mean, it's money to be made. And I mean, I guess that comes back to the proposition that, you know, these people say they want to regulate themselves and you know, this comes sort of the international policy-making paradigm about, oh, yes, we can put on a carbon price and then the market will sort out the problem. I mean, that's what Paris said and that's what this mob here say. Oh, look, yes, but, you know, there's a trade in offsets and so on. I mean, the fact is that these people left to their own devices or to regulate themselves or to reduce their emissions on a market-based mechanism will get away with murder.
Yeah,
I mean, literally and metaphorically, and therefore governments have got to crunch them. And this is what I don't think either most of the climate movement or anybody else wants to say. I mean, this is a case for really heavy-handed government intervention. I mean, you know, like, you are not going to do this anymore. Because all the mechanisms to reduce emissions have resulted in emissions continuing to increase. I mean, we've had, you know, 29-30 reiterations of these annual conference of the parties, COP climate-making policy sort of confests, I mean, the last two of which were hosted by petrostates, and it keeps on going up. And they can go round and round and round and talk about markets and prices and so on, but the problem just gets worse. And I mean, Kevin, I think another thing that's really sort of important at the moment that's gone a bit under the radar is the fact that demand for energy is going up really quickly at the moment. I mean, people have seen all the stuff about AI and servers, and I mean, there's been you know, stories about how these server farms are actually using water that's not available. I mean, they're going to have terrible consequences for local communities and for farmers, because you've got to cool the things. But, I mean, the amount of energy that service, and particularly AI, but also cloud services, because nothing's on your computer, everything's in the cloud now, your music, you know, your life. And as a consequence of that, and then you've got big expansion of energy use, particularly in India and China, and then you've got this more demand for electricity because, for example, we're electrifying transport. So cars that used to use oil, you know, now are using more electricity. So the demand for electricity is going up quite rapidly, and the faster the demand rises, the more difficult it is to decarbonise it. I mean, for example, let's say Australia can replace 2% of its total energy capacity with renewables each year, which is quite a big ask, 2%. So if energy demand grows 2%, that means that it's just dealing with the increase, the renewables are dealing with the increased demand for energy, but it's actually not cutting into the base. Mm. If you can do 2% renewables a year, but energy demand is going up 4%, that actually means that fossil fuel use will go up 2%. If you have an economic crash and the demand goes down, you're much better off. So the fact is that around the world so far, and it's really sad but true, is that renewable energy is adding to the energy supply, but in toto, it's not replacing fossil fuels yet. Yeah. And the whole digital AI thing is, it's a catastrophe on many levels, I think. I'm a Luddite. But in terms of climate, it is a really bad thing.
Yeah, I was going to go to AI when you went to AI, so we've got there.
AI is leading the conversation now. Who are you?
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but my one of my main concerns is also, you did refer to it, but the amount of water the things use. I mean, that's going to create massive problems, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yes, here and in the US, I mean, often these server farms are built in rural areas, partly because the land is cheaper than building them in cities. I mean, that's sort of logical in a way. And therefore, they're drawing on a local water supply. And, I mean, there are cases documented in the States now where they're already impacting the capacity of local people to live in towns and to farm. And I doubt that it'll be any different here. I mean, you can see in Australia they're likely to be built in the regions. They're likely to be built, you know, perhaps near large renewable energy resources. And we'll have the same thing here. And with Murray Watt as the Minister for Water, you'd be really worried.
Yeah, does Murray Watt actually know that his official title is Minister for the Environment or not?
Oh, look, isn't he? Yeah, I mean, he's just I can't use the words that I'd get away with, but I mean, he just seems to me a shocker. I mean, he's sort of like the fix-it guy. You know, he got moved from agriculture to what was industrial relations.
Yeah, and put in the administrator of the CFMEU.
Yeah. So he was like the hitman, the policy hitman, and now they've moved him into this where, I mean, Tanya Plibersek just did shocking things and, you know, probably had to have an extra drink each night to, you know, ease the conscience, whereas I don't think that would be Murray's case.
I know Murray's quite happy. David, we're out of time, but just finish on this show. This show does depress people no end, but is there any light at the end of it all?
I think the lawfare stuff is really interesting. I mean, the fact that the Hunter Valley people won, the fact that this, you know, the Vanuatu law students won the International Court of Justice. I mean, I think that shows that, you know, the fight is really on. And it was a great result, and the International Court of Justice opinion was really strong, and even the Vanuatu representatives and the students said this was a stronger opinion than we expected to get out of it. So, like, it was a bit of a bonus.
But, okay, we finish on a positive note. That's good to know, David. We'll have to follow
up
because it's not going to go away in the immediate, but thanks for your time, David.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Okay. Righty-o. David Spratt there, well known, and it's almost 10 o'clock. Joe's in the next studio, so...
That's right.
Housing next week.
Yeah.
No, not housing, transport next week.
Yes,
transport.
Of course. All right. Thanks for listening.
Come to the Save Public Housing Mass Rally this Saturday, August the 2nd at 11 a.m. at the Victorian State Library. During this terrible housing crisis, the Victorian State Government wants to demolish 6,660 homes and privatise public housing, selling off public land to greedy developers. This is an attack on everyone, especially Indigenous people, the disabled, poor and vulnerable. So come to the Save Public Housing Mass Rally this Saturday, August the 2nd at 11 a.m. at the Victorian State Library.
A 3CR supporter.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.